Please take your copy of God's Word, turn back to the first passage we read, Genesis 30. Continue our exposition of this Old Testament book. And we pick up at verse 25, Genesis 30, verse 25. We'll consider the remainder of this chapter. Genesis 30, verse 25, "And it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said unto Laban, Send me away, that I may go unto mine own place and to my country." And we read the whole chapter earlier. The believer becomes very conscious of the fact that they live in a hostile world. So the pilgrimage for the Christian is an ascent all the way up, en route to glory. And it is not only an ascent uphill, all the while the devil is seeking to pull the believer backward. The world is seeking to trip up the believer, and indwelling sin is weighing down the believer all the way along. And so there is hostility, there is difficulty. And it manifests itself even in relationships. The Christian lives in the world, though they are not of the world. And we interface with those who are hostile to the Lord, hostile to His Word, hostile to His people. And that, too, provides a point of difficulty for the Lord's people. We see that here in Genesis chapter 30. We've already noted this relationship between Jacob, and Laban, which has been mixed. It's been entangling. There's been much trickery and deceit and mischief woven throughout it. And in this text, it is abundantly clear that both Laban's motives and his actions are filled with sinister mischief. We see him plotting and planning and conniving in order to profit himself. But at the first, and I think cursory, reading of this text, it may seem that Jacob is also conniving. It may seem that Jacob is also conniving. Indeed, there are some commentators who take that line quite strongly. But I think you'll note that upon a closer look of what is described in this passage, the facts actually prove the opposite. That what we see here is Jacob exercising his faith and exercising sound wisdom in his dealings with Laban. And I think that will become evident as we unpack this. So there is a bargain that results in blessing. But through all of that, we see Jacob renewing, reviving, and exercising his faith before the Lord. So we notice three things. First of all, it is an obedient faith. So Jacob's exercise is one of an obedient faith. Verse 25, we just read. Verse 26, "Give me my wives and my children for whom I have served thee, and let me go, for thou knowest my service, which I have done thee." Now this comes, as the text says, immediately on the heels of the birth of Joseph. So Rachel has finally conceived. She's carried this child, given birth to it, and she feels as if the Lord has removed the reproach from her. And it seems, in response to this, it came to pass when Rachel had borne Joseph that Jacob said unto Laban. So there's something that's going on within Jacob's own heart and mind, something that has stirred him, something that has renewed his thoughts for home and his inclination and desire to go that way. And it is no doubt the fulfillment of the promise. So he's been promised a seed. And of course, he had initially had contact with Rachel. He had chosen Rachel and was wed to her second after Leah. But now that Rachel, the one whom had set his heart upon, has given birth, there is a sense of along with the birth of the other children by the handmaids and by Leah, there's a sense of fulfillment in the promise that God has given to him. And so it's not as if over this very long period of time that his love has waxed cold. He still has affection for what God has defined as the land of promise. His heart is still there. He still has love for it. In other words, he still feels himself to be a stranger. You know, you can move from perhaps one state to another, or maybe even move from one country to another, and after a few years you begin to think, well, this is now home, and it feels like home. For Jacob, that was not the case. He still recognizes he's an alien. He's a stranger. He's in a foreign land. He is a pilgrim, and that pilgrim mentality has been preserved for him. And so he is now arising in this context with obedience unto the Lord. Now, we know it's obedience for a number of reasons, but it's confirmed for us in the next chapter, in chapter 31, verse 13, where he's telling, he's recounting things, and he says, or he's this interface with the Lord, I am the God of Bethel, where thou anointest the pillar, and where thou vowest a vow unto me, now arise, get thee out from this land, and return unto the land of thy kindred. So he's responding to the call and command of God. God is the one who sent him away. God is the one who met him at Bethel. God is the one who gave him promises and going into Syria. God has sustained him in that. And now God is the one who is calling him to return. So there's an obedience in the expression of his faith. He is following the Lord. And you'll note that in the interim, during his time in Syria, he's been conducting himself with a godly, a God-fearing integrity. He swore to his own hurt, and yet he did not change. He kept the word that he had pledged to Laban. And he has walked, therefore, before in the fear of the Lord. And there are those, I think one of the places the commentators go off is they think, well, you know, here's Jacob, he's conniving, he's trying to pursue some get-rich-quick scheme and the latter part of this chapter and so on. That flies in the face of the text itself. Because here we see him saying, send me away that I may go to my own place and my own country. Give me my wives and children. Let me go. In other words, Jacob at this point is prepared to gather his family and to take the pilgrimage back to the promised land. Well, what are the implications of that? He's willing to leave immediately. It means that he is willing to return to the land in relative poverty. He's prepared to obey and go home now, though he has a paucity of resources, small income. So he spent these 14 years plus laboring in order to enrich Laban. He has been building Laban's enterprise. He's been building Laban's fiefdom, if you will. It has not been for himself. He's been given a competent portion in terms of sustenance and so on. But in terms of building, of investing, and of multiplying, all of that has been in the service of Laban. Everything he's done has been to increase Laban's holdings and Laban's well-being. And now he's willing, after all of that sacrifice, to go home without anything. And this too is tied back. You see the faith peering through because it's tied back to the promise. At Bethel, the Lord had promised that he wouldn't leave him or forsake him, that he would be with him all the way. He promised him a seed, and he promised him land. But during his pilgrimage into Syria, the Lord promised him bread and raiment. So Jacob knows that what the Lord had promised, he had fulfilled. He had been clothed with the necessities of life, and he had been given, him and his household, the food that was necessary for them to live. That's all that had been promised, right? The Lord promised him this bread and raiment, and the Lord had fulfilled it. So Jacob, everything that is indicated in the text demonstrates that Jacob is not covetous. Jacob is not in pursuit of unjust gain. He's not even covetous of wealth generally. He is walking by faith. The Lord has given him the seed. Rachel is now conceived. The Lord has called him to return, and he's ready to go back to the land. That, after all, is the land of promise, the place where there is to be plenty and bounty that the Lord would eventually bestow upon his people. If anything, his expectation would be to receive it there, in the place that God had promised it. And so he's walking by faith, and it's an obedient faith, obedient to the Lord, that is. And it is not clever strategies, right? It's not as if he's manipulating, and the temptation is perpetual for the Lord's people to rely upon strategy rather than upon faith. What does the Lord say? We sing in Psalm 127, if the Lord builds the house, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. We have to walk by faith in the Lord building the house of his people. But the temptation is for God's people, and it's true by way of application for ourselves. The temptation is to begin to set our affection on things here. You know, it would be equivalent to Jacob settling down in Syria and thinking, you know, this place will do. It's suitable. It's grown on me, and so on. The Christian does the equivalent when we begin to set our hearts, our minds on this earth, on earthiness, on earthly mindedness, and begin to think that this is it, this will do, and we lose the pilgrim mentality. We lose the sense of being aliens and foreigners in a strange land. And when that happens, we begin to walk by sight rather than by faith. And we begin to perhaps swear to our own hurt and be tempted to reel that back in order to preserve and to protect ourselves and so on. And we begin to pursue clever strategies rather than walking by faith in the Lord. And that can be in terms of how to navigate our preparation for life and our calling. It can be in terms of, you know, scheming and so on with finance and, you know, get-rich-quick schemes, which are unbiblical. Or it can be, you know, manipulating our way into relationships that we think are advantageous to us. And you can multiply the examples. But there is this strategizing that is fleshly. We're not talking about the prudent exercise of good judgment, but the scheming that is so often tempting for earthly-minded people, rather than to walk by faith, to seek first his kingdom and righteousness, and trust that he will add these other things after us, becoming like the Gentiles who are pursuing, you know, running in circles in order to collect as much dirt and dust as they're able from this world. Not so with Jacob. Jacob is walking by faith, and it is an obedient faith, obedient to the Lord. Secondly, it is a submissive faith. Verse 27, and Laban said unto him, I pray thee, if I have found favor in thine eyes, tarry, for I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. And he said, appoint me thy wages, and I will give it. And he said unto him, thou knowest how I have served thee, and how thy cattle was with me. For it was little which thou hadst before I came, and it is now increased unto a multitude. And the Lord hath blessed thee since my coming. And now when shall I provide for mine own house also? And he said, what shall I give thee? And Jacob said, thou shalt not give me anything. If thou wilt do this thing for me, I will again feed and keep thy flock. And then from there to verse 36, you have him describing the arrangement of cattle and the offspring of the cattle that currently exists. So here we have a submissive faith. By that I mean submissive to God. An expression of submissive faith to God. Because what Jacob is doing is he is casting himself on God's providence. He's putting himself in the Lord's own hands. He is basically allowing the Lord to order how things will fall out for him. and he is trusting the Lord in that. So you have Laban, and here is Laban's protest. What a lesson in contrast. Here is Laban, and he is asking him to stay. And Laban is so flagrant that he even acknowledges his motive. It's not because I love your company, or I love my daughters, or I love the grandkids, or I love this set or the other thing, much less I love your God. But rather, he says, it is for self-serving interests. He says, I've come to see, right? He's showing, in essence, his covetousness without apology. He says, I have learned by experience that the Lord hath blessed me for thy sake. In other words, he is viewing Jacob not in terms of real, authentic relationships, father-in-law, son-in-law. He is viewing Jacob as an object, not as a person. He's viewing him as a good luck charm. He's viewing him as a means to his own personal end. Using you, Jacob, profits me. There is something very base in that. When there are those who begin to shift toward viewing others as objects to be used for themselves. So here is Laban flagrantly self-serving. And Jacob, in the arrangement that is described, which we'll discuss, what we see with Jacob, by way of contrast, is a disinterested exercise of faith. In other words, unselfish exercise of faith. He is not clinging to things. He is not trying to gather things to himself. Indeed, in the midst of this description, he says what his purpose is. Rather than gain, he says, verse 33, so shall my righteousness answer for me in time to come. So this disinterested, unselfish arrangement is an expression of submission to the Lord. So here's Laban. Laban is saying, I have learned by experience. Well, isn't that interesting? What have you learned, Laban, by experience? You're such a good student. What is your diligent investigation yielded for you? He says, I've learned by experience, the Lord bless me for thy sake. Here is a man who does have some exposure to sound theology. He does have some exposure to it, not only in terms of what he's heard from Jacob, but also in terms of what he's seen. He's learned by experience these things. And yet, having received the truth, he is not brought under the power of that truth. So here is a man who is saying, I profess that this is true, but in the same breath acknowledging that he himself is not changed by that truth. He has not been changed by that truth. He saw God's blessing, but he was only interested in the world's goods. He was interested in the temporal tokens that fell to him. He is not interested, for example, in God himself. He's not saying, oh, that I should know Jehovah. Oh, that I could be brought to faith in Jehovah. That I would be brought into covenant with Jehovah. That Jehovah would come and take me and bring me unto himself. That I might learn to worship him. Oh, that I might forsake all of the idolatry of my household and family, and that I might give myself entirely to the Lord and might be found in him. No, he sees these temporal tokens and says, that's what I want. But I want the stuff your God gives, but I don't want the God who gives it. I don't want the God who gives it. And this is tragic, right? It's absolutely tragic. It's tragic wherever we see this. I mean, those within the visible church who recognize that to be in the covenant is advantageous to us, that there are privileges and protections that come, and to be a beneficiary of some of the temporal expressions of that without any interest in the giver of all good gifts, without any interest in God himself. I mean, is that true of you? I mean, is it true there are those attracted even to the Reformed faith because they think, well, there's intellectual prowess, or there's answer to, you know, questions and theological insight, or there's really successful and practical benefit in terms of morality and family and so on and so forth. And people think, well, I want to be a part of that. I see godly families and I see the blessings, and I want to have a share in that too. And they can come in and join themselves to the Lord's house and so on. And yet there is very little of God in their thoughts, very little interest in the Lord himself and in submission to him and love for him and in faith in him and so on and so forth. And it is an utter tragedy when this happens. Now, what Laban sees is true. He is being blessed for Jacob's sake, because the Lord promised that those who bless his people will be blessed and those who curse them will be cursed. And that is applicable to the people of God down through the ages. And so we see this in history. Wherever the church is found and it is countenanced and supported and so on, nations bless, communities bless, end up being blessed. We see the payoff that comes from that, right? Look, for example, at Roman Catholic countries and all of their degradation and poverty, relatively speaking. Look at the, you know, many of the pagan countries with their idolatry and so on, and then look where the countries where the Protestant religion has flourished. Now, all of that is fading, right? Because the Western world is going into a descent into paganism itself. But you can see some of those connections that were there, and it's been seen in history. But what is that if you don't have the God of heaven? You know, what is it to be a beneficiary of some of these temporal blessings without having faith in the Lord himself? Well, Jacob is one who does have faith, and it's a submissive faith, because in the account that's given to us here, Jacob intentionally puts himself in a position of disadvantage. He is disadvantaged by this arrangement. So here is Laban, and he's saying, appoint me thy wages, I'll give it. And he says, Jacob no doubt is thinking, been there, done that, seen all of that before, right? We've been through this before, and we're not going there again. And so he says, no, I'm not going to. In verse 31, what shall I give thee? And he says, thou shalt not give me anything. I'm not going to take anything from you. No doubt he's thinking, perhaps similar to Abraham, remember, when he delivered the children of the plain and brought them back, the kings wanted to reward him, and he said, no, you're not going to give me anything because you're not going to take credit for God's blessing that he gives me. That could be an element. But certainly his experience in history with Laban is another element. He could say, I've learned by experience that you are not a man of integrity and don't keep your word, and therefore I'm not going to enter into, you know, contractual relationship with you on those terms. And instead, he purposely puts himself in a position of disadvantage. He's acknowledging that he has to provide for his own house. That's in keeping with what we see in 1 Timothy 5, verse 8. He has to provide for his own, verse 30, since my coming. Now when shall I provide for mine own house also? But he's going to do it in a way that will magnify God and his glory. He says what Laban already knows. Thou knowest. The emphasis is there. Thou knowest how I have served thee. You had nothing. You had relatively little before I came, and you have increased in a multitude as a result of this. You know this. You know all of these things. And now he says, here will be the arrangement. And he basically tells Laban, you get all of the best, and I get all of the leftovers. So the less attractive, right, the gristled, the multicolored, the blotches and spotches and whatever cattle are going to be mine. And Laban, you get to keep the beautiful ones, right? The ones that are solid color. Other than the case with the sheep, you have brown ones that he gets. So you're going to get the ones that are of more monetary value and of greater desire and attraction and usefulness and so on. So he gives Laban the best. Now, what happens is the offspring of these two categories will be divided between them. So Laban, this is what I mean by submissive faith. Jacob, rather, is casting himself on providence. He cannot predict, nor can Laban predict, what colors and markings the offspring will have. Right? You can't predict these for certain. And so, or if some will be more productive or and others less productive. And so he's casting himself upon the Lord in this. And he's saying, in essence, I'm going to walk by faith. I'm going to submit to the Lord in faith. And you see, of course, Laban's deceit in this. I mean, Jacob calls him out for it later when he says in verse 7 of the next chapter, your father hath deceived me, changed my wages 10 times, but God suffered him not to hurt me. You'll see it here in this passage, because what is Laban says, great, 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 all good, I'll agree to this arrangement. And then Laban takes all of the cattle that are of the kind and color that whose offspring will go to Jacob, and he immediately that day removes them. And he puts 3 days separation and leaves them, Laban, with his sons. So all the gristled and the speckled goats and the brown among the sheep and so on, these are taken and separated 3 days' journey. So what's happening here? Laban is saying, I mean, if any of you have ever bred dogs or cats, or if you've had hamsters in your house that have had babies, you know that generally speaking, the traits of the parents, you know, go to the offspring. And so if you want to breed brown labs, then it'd be better to use brown labs, right? Not a golden one and a black one, but 2 brown ones in order to concentrate the gene pool. And they, of course, knew this far better than we do in terms of the science of raising livestock and so on. So he takes all those cattle away and only leaves the kind for Jacob to care for that are Laban's kind. So you would think, theoretically, that they're going to produce predominantly, statistically, those kind. Therefore, Laban is going to be further enriched, right? But what happens? Jacob is walking with a submissive faith. Here is Laban. In all of his attempts to get everything, he loses. In his attempt to get, he loses all. In fact, it would seem as if when at the beginning of our text in verse 25 and verse 27 and so on, if he were to have accepted Jacob's proposal at that point and said, Jacob, you just leave with nothing, you know, the food and clothes on your back and so on, he would have been better off. Laban would have been better off at that point. But because of his scheming and desire to get more, he ends up losing all. Or most of all. And it's the Lord, of course, because Jacob's submissive faith is being owned from heaven. God hath taken away the cattle of your father and given them to me. Jacob recognizes that it is God who is doing this. Thirdly, it is a blessed faith. Thirdly, it is a blessed faith. Picking up verse 37, Jacob took him rods of green poplar and of hazel and chestnut tree, and pilled white streaks in them, and made the white appear which was in the rods, and he set the rods which he had pilled before the flocks in the gutters in the watering troughs when the flocks came to drink, that they should conceive when they came to drink. And the flocks conceived before the rods and brought forth cattle, ring-straked, speckled, and spotted. And Jacob did separate the lambs and set the faces of the flocks toward the ring-straked and all the brown in the flock of Laban. And he put his own flocks by themselves and put them not unto Laban's cattle. And it came to pass, whensoever the stronger cattle did conceive, Jacob laid the rods before the eyes of the cattle in the gutters, that they might conceive among the rods. When the cattle were feeble, he put them not in, so the feebler were Laban's and the stronger Jacob's. And the man increased exceedingly and had much cattle and maidservants and menservants and camels and asses. So here we see a blessed faith. Now you think, well, isn't there some conniving here? No, there's actually, on Jacob's part, the contractual agreement is being perfectly kept. He's sticking to his word. And he's using prudence and wisdom and you know, the knowledge of farming and so on in order to advantage himself in a lawful way. So that's what we see happening here. Now, the description that's given to us is obviously very puzzling to us. You know, we read this and here he is peeling, you know, bark off of certain types of wood, and he's sticking them in the watering trough so that when they come to drink, they're rubbing against things, are seeing these things and conceiving as a result of that, and so on. And so we scratch our heads and we think this is very strange and very difficult to understand. And you're in good company, because for at least the last 2,000 plus years, the commentators have been beside themselves, and people have come up with all sorts of, some of them harebrained ideas on what this can mean. But after all of the bluster, really to no substantial conclusions. So we don't know all that this entailed. So it could have been a natural means of increasing fertility in this way, or they could have conceived of it in that way. That's possible. I don't think at all likely. You know, some have said, well, it was just some superstitious thing. There's no evidence that that's the case. Quite to the contrary, when you get to the next chapter and begin to read part of the commentary on what's happened here. So that's not the case either. It would seem to me that whatever speculation there might be on the significance of this method with the pilled bark and them going into the gutters and so on and so forth, it is not a crafty scheme. So that it is not a crafty scheme. It is not a form of dishonesty. In fact, Laban would have been well aware of what he was doing. It's not as if these things would have been hidden from him or his servants. Indeed, for all we know, they laughed him to scorn for what he was doing. So it's not dishonesty. What is it? Whatever the background details are that haven't been revealed to us, it was at God's direction, and it was utilized for God's blessing. That's what we need to have clear and at the forefront of our minds. So you go to the next chapter, and I read verse 9, God hath taken away the cattle. And he says in verse 11, the angel of God spake unto me in a dream, saying, Jacob. And I said, here am I. And he said, lift up now thine eyes and see, all the rams which leap upon the cattle are ring-straked and speckled and gristled, for I have seen all that Laban doeth unto thee. I am the God of Bethel. So there's perhaps some measure of revelation here, even in terms of what he does. But the point is, God is the one who is multiplying the blessing upon believing Jacob. Right? You can get bogged down in some of the rabbit trails of what the pilled bark was and so on, and miss the point entirely. The point is that God was doing something. God was at work here. And it's similar perhaps to, you know, you think of the Gospels, and there is Jesus, and you have the blind man, and Jesus takes and spits, right? And he mixes the spit and makes like this clay, and then he puts that on his eyes. And the point isn't that there's some sort of, you know, medicinal benefit that Jesus was utilizing in order to treat the man's eyes. You've missed the point altogether in that circumstance. It's a miracle. It's supernatural. And whatever the significance of making that clay from the spittle, the point is God was healing the blind man and making him to see. And by way of parallel, you see the same thing here, the emphasis here. This is a blessed faith. God is recognizing and owning all that Jacob is doing. He is indeed demonstrating that his righteousness is answering for him. His righteousness is answering for him. Jacob has been incredibly self-denying in his faith. He has sacrificed severely on the behalf of his father-in-law. He has been incredibly diligent and industrious. Indeed, he's built a small empire for Laban, you know, previously. And what is the Lord doing? The Lord is coming to him. He hasn't sought his own interest. He hasn't sought his own concerns initially. And now the Lord is coming and saying, in essence, you, Jacob, have been faithful in little. You've been faithful in little, and now I'm going to make you, give you responsibility for caring for much. The Lord's adding his own blessing upon him. And so here is Jacob, in the words of the New Testament, he is serving with a single eye. Right? He is not serving as a men pleaser. He's not just watching over his shoulder to see if there's a smile on the household of Laban, but he actually has his eye of faith glued on God himself, and he is seeking to serve the Lord in this call of service that God has given to him. And in doing so, the Lord opens the door of blessing. Why is that? Because the Lord will always bless whatever serves the Lord's own glory. So our chief end is to glorify him. Remember, God's chief interest, God's chief concern is in the magnifying of his own glory. When we align ourselves with God's own intention and we devote ourselves with sincerity from the heart and faith to the promoting and advancement of the Lord's own glory, he will put wind in those sails. He will multiply his blessing in order to multiply his own glory. You see that? And so the Lord is blessing him and rewarding him and strengthening him and providing for him and encouraging him so that as he returns to the promised land, he's not going to return with the shirt on his back. You'll remember that when he comes to Esau, he's like, I am loaded. I am stretched out over a humongous length, you know, of space, of all of the stuff that the Lord had given to him. He's returning home full. He left empty, and he's returning home full under the blessing and bounty of God himself. Verse 43, the man increased exceedingly and had much cattle and maidservants and men servants and camels and asses. So, biblically speaking, submissive faith feels vulnerable. You know, humanly speaking, it feels vulnerable to put ourselves and our interests, our cares, and our concerns into the hand of another. Right? There's the natural inclination is for control. And we'll put that under the guise of, well, we're being responsible and we're being diligent and we're being, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And all that's garbage most of the time. I mean, it's an excuse for the fact that we want to be the ones who are sovereign. We want to be the ones in control of steering our own destiny. And so to come to the Lord and, in the words of Rutherford, to hand him a blank check and say, write on it whatever you want, to submit ourselves to the Lord, to take from us as much as he wants or to give as much as he sees fit, and to walk in holiness before him, to the world seems crazy, seems absolutely irrational, but it is actually wisdom. It is actually the safest, the soundest, the most reasonable thing that a person can possibly do. Hear the living and true God, to commit ourselves unto him. As we saw, was it on Wednesday night, the committing of our souls unto the Lord, to walk by faith in the Lord, to cast all of our cares upon the Lord in the assurance that he cares for us, glorifies God, which is our greatest concern. But it also puts us in the path that is the sweetest and the safest. And the result is that submissive faith gives way to a blessed faith. The Lord is not going to rob and starve his own people who are trusting him and depending upon him and looking to him and holding fast to him and seeking his glory and so on. He's going to provide the spiritual bounty that we desire. He's going to fill the soul with refreshment in communion with God. He's going to give us intimacy and sweetness in the secret place. He's going to enlarge our hearts in prayer. And then he's going to come and bless beyond what we ask in those prayers. He's going to cause his kingdom to advance near to us and in association with the things that we are carrying on our heart before the Lord. He's going to cause the kingdom to advance in those things. And the Lord's going to give blessing. And yes, he will give the competent portion that we need as well in order to sustain us to keep serving him and to keep denying ourselves for him and to keep sacrificing for him and so on. The Lord will add his richest blessing. And this is exactly what's happened. Jacob is walking by faith, obediently and submissively, and it yields the blessing. He says, God is the one who's done it. As you'll see in the next chapter, God has done it. The Lord said unto Jacob, verse 3, return unto the land of thy fathers. Verse 9, God hath taken away the cattle of thy father. Verse 11, the angel spake to me in a dream. It is the God of Bethel that is at work here. God is magnified in the exercise of faith. Why? Faith makes much of God. Right? Faith is so beautiful to the Lord and to his people, because faith makes much of the Lord. We are receiving things in faith. We are depending. We are seeing things by faith. But in every facet of the expressions of faith, it magnifies God as saying everything is found in him. Everything belongs to him. All the glory goes to him. Our dependence is entirely upon him. Faith makes much of the Lord himself, and God is glorified through these means. It's true for the most needy, unconverted sinner, wallowing in the blood, in their own blood, the blood of their own sin, defiled, polluted, alienated, rebellious, condemned by the Lord. What happens? The gospel comes and it rings in the ear. A trumpet is blown. And it rings into the ear and into the heart of a needy sinner. And they cease looking at themselves. And in the exercise of faith, they begin looking at him. Beholding him. Seeing him. Coming to him. Receiving him. It's saying here, Christ is all in all. Christ is the forgiver of sins. Christ is the atoning sacrifice for sins. Christ is the resurrection and the life. Christ is all in all. And we must have him and hold him and receive him and delight in him. This, my friends, is a blessed faith. And so, though we see in this passage a great deal of unscrupulous behavior on the part of Laban, we see the exercise of sound faith in Jacob, a faith that makes much of Christ and much of God's glory. Let's stand for prayer. O Lord, our God in heaven, increase the faith of those who are trusting in the Redeemer, and grant faith to those who are ignorant of him. Grant that we would glorify thy name in making much of Christ. Give us, O Lord, a sweet submission. Give us grace to walk in obedience to the revealed will. And grant that we would have the blessing that comes from these things, the blessing of the Lord, which adds no sorrow with it. We ask it in Jesus' name.